guess we'll get this started as soon as possible. I would just like to thank the Toronto Public Library and the Beguiling for putting on the Toronto Comic Arts Festival. They are the presenters of it, after all. I'd also like to thank Seneca College, our program sponsor. Just like in the movie theaters and all that jazz, please turn off all the cell phones and other noise-making devices. We do not want to disrupt the panelists. And I'll throw it to Heidi, who will introduce our lovely guests.
Hello. Yes, that's working. Hi, thank you for coming. And thank you, TCAF. You know, awesome TCAF. So my name is Heidi MacDonald. I am the graphic novels review editor for Publishers Weekly, as well as the editor-in-chief of the Beat at comicsbeat.com. Yes, a website that I run about comics. And I'm very, very pleased to be here to talk to one of the premier teams in comics, a wonderful marriage of creative talents with Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips, who have been beguiling us with their tales and for many years now. So please join me in welcoming Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. So you guys have done so many books together, which we're here to talk about today, and my question is, as collaborators, was this an arranged marriage where you learned to respect and trust each other over the years, or did you spot each other across a crowded room and know that it was true love right that moment?
It was arranged to start with, right at the beginning.
Was it?
Yeah. The first thing that Ed and I did together, we worked on the scene of the crime that Michael Lark penciled and I inked, Ed wrote, and Shelley Bond put us together on that.
Yeah, but I recall like asking for you on projects even earlier than that. When I was talking to Lou Stathis about doing work, I would always suggest you for something. And I feel like there was an early email where you acknowledged that you had read my own comics or something, and were excited to work with me because of it.
Oh yeah, that was probably true.
Yeah,
it would have been back in the days of faxes. It wouldn't have been email.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah, wouldn't have been email.
Oh my God.
We've been working together for 15 years. So I mean, our first comic we did was in that was 1998 when you were doing Scene of the Crime.
Yeah.
So we're old.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of both. It was maybe Ed had seen Sean, and, yeah. But I mean, Ed, what was it? Why did you want to work with Sean?
Because his stuff looked like, well, I loved just the way he drew in general, but I also loved that his drawings had like a sort of spontaneity and life to them that a lot of guys that were working, you know, for Vertigo at the time, I would look at their stuff and it just didn't appeal to me. And then I remember he was working on Hellblazer with Eddie Campbell. I think that was the first time I saw your work. And Lou Stathis and I were talking about it, and he said, Sean doesn't pencil. And I was like, what? He sends in these rough things that you can't tell what's going on, and then he does all the actual drawing in pen. And I was like, oh, that's terrifying. But I really loved the way he drew everything, and I felt like a lot of artists who use photo reference at all, I feel like their stuff is really lifeless, and Sean's is like completely the opposite of that. Like there's whatever photo reference he does is usually just to get whatever pose right, and then he does the actual drawing. And there's still a lot of emotion in the characters and a lot of facial expression. And I describe facial expressions in my scripts more than I describe backgrounds. So,
yeah.
A lot of furrowed brows.
Yeah.
Well, so let me ask Sean. I mean, you know, were you familiar with Ed's work? I mean, obviously I've seen The Crime.
I think I'd read Low Life then. Either I hadn't read it, and I did when I first heard it, but I'd read the early stuff you'd done for Vertigo, the Prez, and things like that.
What's your work? Expert in Ed's work.
Yeah. I don't know, you hadn't done that much by then.
Yeah, I hadn't done much.
I'd read Low Life, yeah.
Yeah, well then let's walk through some of the greatest hits here. With Sleeper. So that was your first, Brubaker Phillips production, correct? One on my mind.
Our first long one. We did a thing, I wrote a thing for DC called Batman Gotham Noir that was like a story. Jim Gordon in the 40s, and Batman's like a figment of his imagination.
An Elseworlds book.
Yeah, it was an Elseworlds, and I didn't write it specifically for Sean. I wrote it for Mike Carlin, and then we tried to find an artist, and he suggested Sean, who was at that point inking Scene of the Crime, and Sean said yes, and I was like, oh, that's great, and then Sean took the job drawing Wildcats right after that, and so it took a year and a half to draw the book. I'd get a batch of pages every 4 or 5 months. There'd be a batch of pages of that.
I was busy.
And then when Sleeper came up, Sean was the first name I suggested because he had just finished doing Wildcats, and at that point, especially Wildstorm paid better than DC, even though they were
slightly $20 or something,
which is a lot as a writer.
Yeah.
so at this time you had been doing Vertigo stuff and
a little bit,
and I mean, I think Sleeper was. I mean, you've been doing some of the Batman stuff. I mean, what was, like, you know, Sleeper did tie into the Wildstorm superhero universe.
Yeah, to my eternal regret.
So, you said that. I mean, was it, like, was there any choice at that point, though?
I mean, at that point in my career, I think anyone offering me a job to pay me to do something that I created, you know, with an artist that I wanted to work with, I didn't think too far ahead. And, you know, Jim Lee had really liked this first issue of a miniseries I'd written for them, and he had asked Scott to figure out a way for me to spin that off into something bigger. And at that point, I didn't really even want to write any more superhero comics beyond. I was doing Batman, and it seemed like that was just too much superheroes for me, which is crazy, because I spent the next 15 years of my life writing superheroes. But Scott called me up, and he said, we want some kind of spin-off out of Point Blank. Do you have any ideas? And I said, no, I don't have any ideas. And I hung up the phone, and then 2 seconds later, I called him back, and I said, what about Donnie Brasco as a superhero? And he was like, oh, that's great. And so I wrote up, like, a one-page pitch, and he sent it to Sean, and Sean did the character sketch, and the series was greenlit all of a sudden. I was like, oh, okay, let's do that then. So at that point, I hadn't really thought about it. If I'd sat on it, you know, looking in hindsight, I would send an email to myself and say, change it and keep it for yourself.
So, yeah, but I, you know.
But yeah, hindsight is like 100-100.
So, you know, perhaps things would have gone differently. So Sean, when you, when you got Ed's script, you know, with all the facial descriptions and everything.
Yes.
And maybe just a tiny bit wordy, I think, maybe. but in a really good way. So, I mean, did you change your approach at all? I mean, was this the standard approach that you had for other works, or did you adjust it?
Well, for Sleeper, I did do one thing differently to what I did before. The way the pages were composed. Every page had a big super panel, and then the rest of the panels sort of cascaded across it in different weird ways, and sometimes they went like anti-clockwise around the page, and you read it by following the balloons.
I remember one where it read like a spiral, and the last panel was on the left side, not the right.
So that was just something to keep it interesting for me. Before Sleeper came along, I'd never read any Wildstorm books, and I picked up a few, and they had all these things where you'd get a lot of inset panels, a lot of jagged borders, a lot of stuff that didn't really make any sense why it was there. It just looked cool. And if I was going to do stuff like that and do sort of Wildstorm type stuff, I wanted it to make sense. So that's the only thing I did. And I tried the technique out on an issue of Batman that Ed and I did.
Oh, yeah.
Just to see if it would actually work over more than a couple of pages. That was the only thing, really. I picked up a brush rather than a pen as well. I've been drawing Hellblazer for a few years and Wildcats and stuff like that, and it's all getting a bit crisp and fine line stuff. So I just switched to a brush, and that was it.
Yeah, I remember that, I like that stuff.
Did you, you were doing this stuff digitally at that point, back in the olden days?
I did a book called User for Vertigo.
Oh, I just did that, remember?
Yeah. that's for the benefit of the audience, I said like that. And that was purely digital, because I've got a computer, I thought I'd better, you know, get with the times, but most stuff, no. Most stuff isn't digital at all.
Do you do your covers?
No, they're usually by hand.
You do the colouring on the computer.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff like the tile covers I've been doing, they've all been painted in watercolour and then in black and white, and then I add the colour digitally. But I like something to sell. I like a piece of original art that someone can buy. I did actually admit to Ed last night that I've we've done a teaser trailer for our next project, which isn't been put out yet, but I did actually admit to Ed that that was done digitally, because he doesn't like digital art.
No, I don't. I don't like anything digital. That's not totally true.
So when Sleeper went on, I mean, how much of it was a 12-issue miniseries to begin with, so you must have had it plotted out pretty tightly. I mean, you knew the beats of it, right?
Yeah, I knew the base. I always know where I'm going, I just don't always know how I'm going to get there. I planned it to be 12 issues because I figured that's the most that we're going to get out of it. Everything Wildstorm was doing was getting canceled around issue 12. And then around the time of issue 10, I was told they were going to relaunch the book with part of this new mature readers line instead. And so the ending that I was going to do in issue 12, I ended up doing in issue 24 instead. But that book only survived just because Jim Lee and Scott Dunbier liked it. Its sales were... It's the worst selling thing we've ever done. And yet at the same time, I've never been to any meeting at like a studio in Hollywood where whoever I'm meeting with isn't a huge fan of it and doesn't have the hardback for me. It's like, I think every copy of it sold out of like Golden Apple or something.
It's a project that still gives, we'd still get money out of that because they keep it in print and every couple of years a new edition.
I bought them to get it, to keep it in print. They acted like it was a huge risk to print the trade paperback. And now, as someone who actually sees print bills, I realize that there's no huge risk involved. Well, for a multi-billion-dollar corporation.
So, Sean, was there anything in the story that you found difficult, or Ed, was there anything? I mean, now you evolved to a real partnership, and like as you worked on it, did you begin to see that you found a muse in this, or?
We don't really work like that. Ed writes the stories and I draw them.
He doesn't ever want me to tell him what's coming next.
I have an idea what happens in any of our books until I actually get to draw it.
Yeah, it's really more was just Sean's so fast and I'm so lazy that it's a great combination because if I don't have him emailing me that he needs pages or script or ideas for covers, I'll just as soon like watch old cartoons on YouTube. And so it really it's like our symbiotic relationship of he needs work and it forces me to be more productive because there's a Fellini had some quote about artistic freedom being the worst shackle of all because. He said if he didn't have the studio telling him when his start date for his movie was, he'd never end up finishing the script, and if he didn't have them setting a release date, he'd never finish editing.
Yeah, that's where you get 8.5, so...
Yeah, exactly, see? But I kind of feel that way. Like, someone asked me, about our new deal where we can do whatever we want. I said, well, it's whatever we want, but Sean still needs pages every month, which is great, because it's like almost freedom. But not enough freedom where I wouldn't actually get anything done.
Yeah.
Right. But it's not like you talk on the phone and you say, oh, man,
I've spoken on. I think we've only spoken on the phone once in our lives.
Yeah, maybe twice, yeah.
Maybe one, yeah.
I mean, this
you've spoken to my wife a few times when she needs to get, like, your tax ID or something.
Yeah, but that's usually only email stuff. Up until this weekend, we'd only seen each other once in the last 5 years.
And that
was 6 months ago.
So this
ago.
Sounds like a special moment.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I saw him yesterday, I'm over it.
We email. I think we email almost every day. Oh, if I don't hear from Sean for a few days, I'm worried he's been hit by a car in my whole life. And especially in England, my God. If he's going to London or something, I just sit there and just please look the right way.
So Ed, you sit and you write your scripts and... But I mean, did you? Let's move forward from Sleeper because
sure.
I mean, how long was it before you worked again on Criminals? A while.
No, we went. I mean, what is it? About a year between.
I did Marvel Zombies for a while before.
You did Marvel Zombies. Yeah, that's right. You were working on that for about 6 months. I was working at Marvel, and I had to get a certain amount of work done before they would let me do a book at Icon. And I pretty much signed my contract at Marvel so that I could get access to the Icon line, because I thought an independent publishing line by the biggest publisher in comics seemed like the best place to try to do something that I felt like would be a hard sell, which is just a straight crime comic. Yeah, I know, right? I think we were in Portugal at a festival in Lisbon and trying to figure out, we had pitched Wildstorm on a project to do right after Sleeper, and I remember Scott Dunbier saying that he didn't think it was going to be commercial enough, which was funny after Sleeper, which is the least commercial comic ever. But what's weird is, like, part of that pitch that I did, I took part of that and expanded it into Fatale. Like, one character from that pitch ended up being the centerpiece for Fatale. So that I don't think I could have figured out how to do that project. But as I was doing that, I realized I was trying to create something more commercial because I was so worried that Sleeper had been such a bad seller. I just wanted to be able to keep doing the kind of comics I wanted to do. So I was putting together a pitch that was very Neil Gaiman-y. Because I thought, that's how you sell comics, if you write like Neil Gaiman. And I realized, like, I can't write like Neil Gaiman. I don't even really like that kind of stuff. I like Neil's stuff, but I don't... If I've ever tried to write fantasy kind of-ish stuff, it's, you know, I'm too much of a Tolkien nerd. I just want to go full fantasy. And so we were in Portugal, I think, and I told Sean that, you know, I had access to this Icon line and we should just do a crime comic. And we started plotting it out and figuring out our grand plan of how to pull it off so that each story would be a self-contained novel and the trade paperbacks would have the name of the story and not the name of the series instead, and which was maybe not the world's greatest idea in retrospect. But it just kind of came out that, you know, I was more interested in just doing straight crime and doing something that wasn't crime with superheroes in it or something. You know, I felt like there was this period of time right before we did Criminal where everybody was launching a book that was sort of like, what if we were a bail bondsman but you had to hunt down supervillains? Or what if you were a lawyer but all your clients were supervillains? Or what if you... It was always something but with the superhero. And I wanted to leave out the but with the superhero part and just go straight crime and write the kind of stuff that if I could do anything I wanted to do, this is what I'd do. And I thought, well, what the hell? We're going to take all the risk ourselves. Yeah. You know, so...
Yeah. I wanted the same thing as well. I mean, I haven't drawn much superhero books over the years, but every time I have, I've always felt I've been faking it. And I'm not really a superhero artist. It'd just be nice to do something that didn't have that stuff. Something you didn't have to apologize for all the time, really.
That's so weird, because when I went from doing Low Life to writing Batman, it was the first time I could explain to my grandmother what I did without having to also include, but it's not pornography. I read Batman. Everybody got it.
So, I mean, was there anything that, like, did you feel more comfortable? I mean, obviously you knew Sean, you know, could do it, and you're both in the same wavelength, but I mean, was there anything that, you know, Ed, you were like, you know, now that I know, you know, we've been road tested, I mean, did you do anything differently, perhaps? Like,
well, we
just
talked. I think after Sleeper, especially, we felt like we got really great critical response from Sleeper, and, you know, decent sales on the trade paperbacks, and a lot of people offering us other work based on it. And I felt like, you know, we talked early on about just trying to make it as new reader accessible as possible, and like how to not, you know, that's why everything in Criminal is all the 3-panel, 9-tier grid.
Yeah, I wanted to make it really easy to read. Yeah,
yeah, really.
You know, those mythical non-comic readers that might read crime fiction or watch crime movies might come pick up our book by mistake.
But, the one thing, we mythical, but at the same time, I think a lot of our fans buy like our Criminal hardbacks and stuff to give to their parents for Christmas and stuff like that, because my dad likes mystery novels, but he hates that I spend so much money on comics, so I gave him your comic, and he loved it, and, you know, and so I get that a lot from people, from our straight crime stuff, I know. And I got that with Scene of the Crime, too. It was, like, a lot of people buying it for their parents. Noah Baumbach, actually, the filmmaker... I met him through a friend and told him I was a big fan of his dad's short stories, and he gave his dad all the Criminal books for Christmas that year or something. So I like hearing stories like that about non-comic readers who get given our stuff. But yeah, I think really it was just, you know, again, just I was just so afraid the book wouldn't sell, and especially since we were taking all the risk, I think we just tried to make it as you know, we hyped the hell out of it and tried to do as much ahead of time to promote the book so we would have a big launch. so that when whenever we leveled out, it would be enough to survive. And there was a few years there where, you know, most of the time we were at Icon, I was paying Sean and our colorist out of pocket ahead of time so they could be able to do the work.
Those Daredevil bucks?
No, that's the second mortgage on the house bucks. But it all worked out in the end. It was you know, it is one of those things. You have to spend money to make money, I guess. And in the end, we now have 15 books that are in print all the time. You know, and that's how you make a living as an independent creator. Is you have a lot of stuff in print that people like.
Mm-hmm. Are you? I'll show my ignorance here, but I mean, are the books still at Icon? I mean.
Not as of a week ago.
Oh,
now
yeah.
That now
it's
I'm
an image.
That was yeah. We're moving all the Icon stuff over to Image. We just finished our 6-month sell-off period at the end of April for the Icon stuff. But they've all been really cool about it. And you know, I mean, there's no point keeping it all at Icon if I'm not writing comics at Marvel, and I don't have any plans to write any more superhero comics. So.
But I mean, you know, we should talk a little bit about that. I mean, you know, this was kind of. Icons, you know, Icon was the image of Marvel Comics, but I mean, you know, they were, you know, my impression was that Marvel would always be more interested in selling their own characters than in promoting a image of creator own works. But you know, I think it was an honest attempt, or you know, still ongoing. So
yeah, I think for me it was. Literally just telling Dan Buckley that I was going to go crazy if I didn't get to write something that I owned, and I couldn't just write superhero comics. I needed this other outlet. And so, yeah, it was kind of that. It's like a reward in a way. I mean, the problem is it's a reward or a favor or this line that if you're an exclusive creator, you have the access to put out books through that line. And, you know, sometimes you can get to stores that wouldn't order a book from Image because they only order stuff from Marvel or DC. But I found over time that, you know, we weren't reaching any place that I probably couldn't have reached through another publisher. And, but yeah, the line is really, it's almost a favor, you know, like to their bigger creators. They started the line for Brian Bendis and, you know, David Mack came with him so that it wouldn't seem like, you know, just a line just to publish one comic. And I know Dan Buckley has had to defend the existence of that line to the shareholders early on, pre-Disney, I don't know about now. But I know he had to defend that line and his line of defense to the shareholders, because they're like, we don't make any money on these. Why are we giving them all the ownership and you know most of the profit? And he said, well, that way Brian Bendis and Ed Brubaker don't go work at other publishers, and they only work for us. And so it makes a lot of sense for them. But yeah, that was the thing, was like, you're in the back of the catalog, and you're not like at Image. Our first issue, we were the first thing in the Image section, and we had 5 full pages.
Right.
So it was really like you go from being a small fish in a giant pond to a big fish in a slightly smaller pond, which is now almost the same size. So for me, it was just, you know, I wanted to make a living doing my own stuff and not have to feel obligated to write comics that I didn't feel like writing anymore. And you're never going to make a living on favors. You know, you're never going to make a living on the line that exists just to keep creators happy when they're writing Young Avengers too. You know.
And of course, I mean, Sean, it didn't really affect you at home.
No, it feels exactly the same.
Yeah. you just sit there and wait and check the email, sort of comes in, and then you stand up.
No, check the email, it doesn't come in.
Percy sends the email. Come on, I need pages! Exclamation point.
Criminal came along with the right time for me. I'd grown up being a big Marvel and DC fan, that's the stuff I read. And by the time Criminal came along, I'd drawn all those characters that were on my list of stuff to do. You know, I started off doing British comics, so I did Judge Dredd and things like that. 2000 AD, went to draw Batman, went to draw Spider-Man, X-Men, all that stuff. And then I'd done them all, and there was nothing there for me. I didn't want to go and do that stuff again and just carry on like that for the next 20 years. So I had to be gathering new stuff.
Yeah. It's always more fun to do your own stuff, I think.
You know, Ed, you, I mean, in all these books, it's very much, you know, you have a style that it opens, and you use a lot of narration, you use first person.
I've switched to third a lot more lately. I don't know why. I think it's George R. R. Martin influence or something.
yeah, you do have your own solo panel. We're going to talk about writing a little bit more. But, you know, you talked about accessibility earlier. And, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, captions are very much out of favor in every way in comics.
Really?
Well, I mean...
I only read art comics.
So. Yeah. Well, I think it's a debate. I mean, I think a lot of times people are like, you know...
Well, you know, I come from the alternative comics world where captions are, you know, I was rereading old Dan Klaus comics the other day, and his captions are 10 times bigger than mine.
I mean, I personally have no problem with them at all, but you know, in mainstream comics, I hate that for superheroes. It's superhero comics.
Those are genre comics.
but I mean, so you don't feel any, like, you know... Like, I'm not supposed to do this, or, you know, when you write a
movie. No, I only ever worry about trying to get whatever needs to get across in the scene, and I also, I think I use as much, I talked to Sean about it the other day, it was, because I thought, well, I do rely on the narration so much, and that's the hardest part of the writing, actually, is I could write the panels and the dialogue in 5 seconds for every page, but then it takes me sometimes whole days to write the narration for one scene. And just to get the words right, because I'm especially at this point, I try to use as few words as I have to. But I also want the comics to take longer to read. I mean, we charge $3.50 an issue, more in Canada. And that's what it says on the back, more in Canada. Or different in Canada, actually. Because I have no idea what the exchange rate is from month to month. But I just want the comics to take longer than, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to read. I love it when someone tells me that they spent a half an hour on one of our issues, because that means... And the thing is, I feel like the narration and the pictures, you know, merge together, but they each have different things going on in them. And there's also, like, subtextual layers. I try to write stories that are, if you read them a second or third time, you get something else out of it. And that there's little moments between characters that you'll only pick up on later, which is... really kind of an influence of, like, you know, I don't know if you've ever seen any Sam Shepard plays, but there's always these little moments in them that if you're not paying attention to, you won't even notice that they're there. Like in True West, when the brother steals the producer's lighter. It's just not, it's never brought up, but it's just that this moment there. And I love stuff like that where you have to really, I want readers that pay attention, and I want to challenge people a bit, but I also feel like I want to make sure by the end of the issue they understood the main point. So I hate when I read a comic and I'm like, what the hell just happened in this thing? So.
Sean, I mean, is there any, I mean, you,
oh, there's a sleeper
do you
bit.
Lay out balloons at all while you're doing your layouts?
Yeah, that's the first thing I do. All the great line stuff that Ed and I do, I always do the lettering as well. And when on the thumbnail of the book, in my sketchbook, I draw the little boxes, and the first thing is do the lettering. And then the way I make my art, even though it's on paper, all the panel borders and lettering are all done on computer, printed out in blue on the boards, and then I ink all the balloons, and then whatever space is left, that's where the drawings go. I'll worry about that after I've figured out.
It's like EC style.
Yeah.
That's how they used to do it. They
give
the printed boards.
And then I just fill the gaps with drawings.
But even on that, like that page there, you did the balloon placement
because
Sean and Michael Art were the first artists I ever worked with who, even when you'd see their pencils, they would sketch in where the balloons were and write all the words to make sure there was enough room for them.
Yeah. Which, that just seems like the sensible thing to do.
You know, a lot of artists don't do that.
Most
artists.
I've had to rewrite whole scenes because they didn't leave enough room for word balloons.
You know, I wish there's a whole bunch of books about making comics coming out. Actually, Brian Bendis is going to write comics, and there's one by, making a very good one by Fred Dunlap, but I hope they put in there, the artists, do the balloons first.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, how important is putting down the balloons first?
Yeah, well, it's really important.
You've got to read it. So.
But, you know, it's interesting because I had Steve Epting start doing it on the teaser pages we did for Velvet. He didn't like doing it, and he prefers not to and just worry about it later. And then sometimes we have to move stuff around. I'll have to break balloons or narration up into more than one, and it's a hassle, but he just... For him, it's the same thing. You know, well, you've been a comic book editor. You know how... I refused to do it ever, and I was called like a pain in the ass for it. But when you turn in your script to DC or Marvel, they want you to number each word balloon, like number one, number two, number three, number four, like on your script. And anytime I would try to do that, it would stall my writing somehow. I'm like, I don't want all these numbers on my page. I don't want to, I'll number the panels, but I don't want to number every balloon. Balloon 11, balloon, like, I just, it would get in the way of the flow of the writing for me, so I just refused to do it. And I was like, that's what assistant editors are for. You know, just take a pen and go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and fax it to the letter. Like, how hard is that? But you know, now I only work with, you know, I mean, but it was weird. No, Chris Eliopoulos has never gotten a balloon in the wrong place on Velvet.
Well, I would honestly, I mean, because of the complexity of what you were just talking about, I honestly think that Sean's line of balloons is probably one of the most key parts of it, because that
does... Well, it's an important part of storytelling, you know.
It's the eye flow.
The balloons lead you right across the page, same way having a character point across the page makes you look in a different direction.
Yeah, it's controlling the flow of the story. I mean, when I used to do my own comics, I always worried about that. When I was a teenager, I would go to Comic-Con, and Brent Anderson would do these storytelling workshops, and he would spend time talking about where balloon placement actually as being an important thing, and he as an artist would always do his own sound effects and balloon placement, because that goes with the art to lead the eye across the page. It's always been really important to me. A lot of people don't even think about that stuff.
I take it further now and ask, if I design all the books as well, I do the logos, I do all the layout, because it's just a part of the visual language of making comics.
You know, I'm sure we bored the audience with that discussion, but it's really important.
Are you guys bored?
Yeah. Okay, good.
One person's not.
Let me talk a little bit, Sean. I wish I'd been able to put this, because I was going to juxtapose your, this is one of your sleeper layouts, with the wild and crazy spiraling panel design. And, you know, one thing I did notice in all of these, because you use the panel grid, you use this kind of design as sleeper, but you avoid ever having that big full page image, you know, like the splash page.
Did a few times, but rarely.
It's so rare.
But also, we never had any bleed. I mean, the way you cut the side, there's no whiteboard around it. In the actual printed books, there was always bleed. Always no bleed, rather. We always had a whiteboard.
You always had a border around the big. Yeah.
Mostly that's because we never knew when the page would be next to an ad.
Right.
Back in, you know, Marvel DC books as ads all the way through. We don't have ads in our books anymore. So we know what page goes next to another page. So it just made it easier to separate the story away from the rest of the comic.
But I mean, I'm interested by it. I mean, what is the use of the grid? I mean, I think like you were saying earlier, you were specifically breaking away from the grid in this to give it
make it look more like an exciting image type whilst on comic. You know,
right.
But filled with through my... Because anything they're doing, it has to have a...
Trying to trick people into thinking it was a Wildstorm comic.
Yeah, but all the starts and choices are there for a reason. And I like setting up rules at the beginning of a project. For this one, it was the layout. Things like flashbacks were gridded in it, so you always subconsciously knew that it was a flashback.
Flashbacks.
They always a gridded page inset, still within the rest of the bigger page.
But, I mean, that page isn't as complicated as some of the stuff you did, but you can see that the word balloons are what draw you to even on the more confusing pages, if you were reading the word balloons, you couldn't be confused because they would lead you from one panel to the next.
Yeah, I wish I had more.
There's a crazy one towards the end.
This is like a page from Cap.
Yeah.
So you can see that now you're playing with the expected, obviously you've gone back to the more straightforward.
Well, we found out most comic readers can't follow the...
And also, this just followed on from Sleeper. I just wanted to change it up again, just for my benefit as well as the benefit of the readers. You know, I wanted to make it interesting to myself. And it takes away some choices of how you can lay out a page when we grid stuff. And it just makes that a little bit quicker, really. Because, we have to churn this stuff out every month, even though we don't quite manage that, really. But
it'll get better.
do you find, I mean, I like you say, you've used large images only a few times. I mean, whereas your cover images, which I'm going to show some more, I mean, obviously, you know, you have these really powerful, you know, the larger it is. I mean, you ever, I don't know, I mean, sometimes, you know, the rule of thumb is like, oh, if it's a big page, it must be like something exciting.
Yeah. We don't have anything exciting happening in that book.
Our next issue is mostly double page spreads, actually,
yeah,
for the first time
really?
Ever.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's an all sex issue, too. It's all double page spreads of graphic sex.
Yeah.
I don't know how. I was like, looking at the pages last night and thinking, yeah, we'll probably get banned by Apple. And then I was like, oh, wait, Apple doesn't have anything to do with it anymore.
Yeah. Wow.
So we'll be banned by Amazon instead.
So you mixed up your storytelling a little bit.
Well, it was really just, it's the second to last issue of the series, and it was the last five issues of it I've been trying to do in a different storytelling style to some degree. It's not this chapter, and it's just a little bit more free, less panels a page, and more weird stuff going on. So when I started writing that issue, I realized that we'd never done, you know, double page spreads, really. And so I thought, oh, fuck it, let's just do it. It'll be towards the end of the collection anyway, so we won't be losing stuff in the bleed. I worry about the gutter space, and I feel like I'm the only person in comics sometimes who cares about gutter space, because I see, I pick up my friend's books, I'll buy, you know, Bendis and Hickman and these guys as hardbacks, and then they have word balloons going right into the gutter, and I can't read them. And it's like the V for Vendetta is one of my favorite comics, and I have the big deluxe hardback version. And even on that version, it's hard to read the word balloons in the middle because they didn't leave enough gutter space on the page. And I'm a fan of print, so I like Sean and I are obsessed about making sure our books are always don't have those kind of weird little problems.
And because we do make our own books, we just send the files to Image or Icon or whoever,
yeah,
and we can control all that stuff.
Yeah, because when you do a trade paperback or a hardback, what you want to do is you want to move the artwork out a little bit more towards the edge of the page, which has to be the opposite every other page. So, but a lot of most Marvel and DC books have all these full bleed pages, so they don't care about that stuff at all. They just, it's exactly the same as the single issue version where you can hold it open. So, I care about stuff like that. I don't want people to have to break the spine to read the book.
I honestly, I don't mean this as a bashing of any particular style of comics. But,
oh, please, go ahead.
No, I mean...
Are you gonna badmouth manga again?
Looking at your collaborations, I mean, it was so obvious, you know, that there's this level of care and quality that goes into them. And I think there are a lot of arbitrary rules that people have, you know, sometimes. Like, I mean, Jim Shooter, who's the editor of Marvel, you know, Energy of Marvel, famously said you couldn't put, you know, no balloon butt up against corner of a panel.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Like they must float in the middle of a panel.
And no, I'm the other way around.
Yeah.
Hands always butt up.
Yeah. So, I mean, do people ever think about these things, really? I mean, about, you know, what are really the readers like, or what makes it easier?
No, we do what we like.
That's
the whole point.
Yeah, it's our aesthetic, I think, more than anything. And, you know, most of my corrections on books I did for Marvel or DC when I was doing lettering proofs, it was always moving balloons. It was always, I was so happy when we went to digital lettering because I could actually fix balloon placement if it was not lettered by Todd Klein, you know, who always got the balloon placement correct. But a lot of guys would, you know, you'd be shocked at where they'd put the balloon. You're like, why are you putting the balloon over the guy's face? You know, like I've had comics come out like that and you know, and then you point it out to the assistant editor and it gets printed that way anyway. So, I mean, I love that we have, I mean, I think, having been a cartoonist and done everything, I think I'm a control freak, and now I work with Sean, he's a total control freak, and like he won't even let us get like Darwin Cook to do like a pinup in the back of an issue because he's too good. But it is like every aspect of the book from the beginning to the end is us. They'll occasionally let someone else have an ad in there, but now we have enough stuff that we can always just advertise our own stuff in the back. So fuck my friends. Take it, fraction.
Let me continue this. This panel started late.
Yeah, we're gonna go over.
Yeah.
It's fine.
So I apologize, and you know,
we don't want to sign comics anymore. We'd rather talk.
Some questions going on here, but let me ask you about one more craft question, which is about coloring. And like you've worked with some very good ones, and I notice you have stuck with the European coloring style. Is that the proper term for it, I guess?
Well, less modeling and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't like all that rendering stuff that you get in the Photoshop colors nowadays. So.
Yeah.
It was interesting when we lost Dave Stewart because Dave misunderstood when I hired Dave for Fatal, I think when I was emailing back and forth, I said, we usually do somewhere between 10 and 12 issues a year. And I think he thought I was hiring for 10 or 12 issues. Mm-hmm. And then he didn't... He has to color like 9 books a month, so he didn't have time for us. And I got lucky. I called up Betty, and I knew she had just quit working for Marvel in a huff. So I was like, please tell me you haven't booked up yet. And so we brought her on. She'd never colored anything in that style before. She'd only done like modeling. She'd only done Marvel... Yeah. Kind of stuff. So I think she actually talked to Dave and looked at some of his pages, and he sort of gave her tips on the style that he, you know, was coloring that stuff in.
I just told her what I didn't like. Well, yeah. What I liked. I don't know. You know, I want a colorist that does stuff that I'd never think of doing.
Yeah. Interesting is I think she brings something to your work. She does bring a more European style to it. Yeah. She does this weird watercolor painted stuff on the backgrounds a lot that she just has these. I guess she made her own brushes for her color stuff. So she does all that dry brush stuff.
Yeah, chunky textures rather than airbrush stuff.
Well, I can't imagine your work with model coloring.
You can see some of it.
I've had some over the years, but not that much because that style matured once I'd started Criminal. So, you know.
When you don't like the... I remember on Sleeper there was conversations with Tony.
I hate all that color on Sleeper. That was really awful.
I thought it was great.
No, I did color a couple of sample pages that time. This is how I want it.
Yeah, I remember that.
And those pages are in the book, but the rest of the pages don't match that at all.
Well, what was it that
he would long. He would do light sources and stuff.
Yeah, most changed light sources. There'd be cell shaded light sources and
shadows on faces that John didn't want.
I mean, all the light sources there in the black and white art doesn't need.
And Sean's too polite because he's British to actually just ask him to do it differently. So he just sat there for 12 issues.
Yeah, and then we got someone new for the second volume. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed that actually.
Tony's a great colorist.
I'm sure he is on other stuff. You know, I was disappointed with it.
Yeah. You know, let me go back a little bit and talk about Fatal and you know the origin of that. You know, you kind of. We just breezed right past you and me coming out here.
So, I thought we were just going to talk about my Archie story.
Yeah,
that should have been the most interesting one to you, Heidi. Did you read that one?
No.
Oh my God.
No, you should send me your reading list. I emailed you.
That's true. I was moving.
But I mean, talk a little bit about the cowl and I mean, it's kind of a spin-off in a way. What is actually a character that started out in?
No.
No?
No, it's totally new.
No, they all look similar though. No.
Yeah, they all look like Sean. Yeah. They all look like John Constantine when Sean drew Hellblazer. No, Fatal was, I think the thing we did right before Fatal was the Last Criminal story, which was sort of my version of what happens when Archie grows up, the Last of the Innocent, where I also tried to, in the first few issues, put as many things that Dr. Wortham complained about comics doing as possible into the story. And that's why issue 2 ends with him stabbing Veronica in the eye. Well, it's not Archie and Veronica, but whatever. They basically are. But that was also a story I was writing. I started writing that when my dad was dying, and it was kind of me sort of processing all my nostalgia and grief into a comic book story that was... Also, I was angry about that Life with Archie comic because he basically got to marry both Betty and Veronica and everything worked out perfect for both of them. And I was like, wait, so either choice would have been the right choice? That's bullshit. So I was like, I want to do the like Patricia Highsmith version of Archie. So that was what I did. And when I got to the end of that, I was like, I don't know what else I do with Criminal after this. And it was also, as much fun as it was kind of painful to write. And I wanted to just do something a little bit different. And I had been talking to Joe Hill a lot and getting tips about horror and stuff. And so I thought, well, I'm going to try doing like a horror noir thing. Because I always liked the fact that Dashiell Hammett and H.P. Lovecraft were publishing stories at the same time in two different pulp magazines that would be sold right next to each other. And I thought, well, why didn't anybody ever just get them to collaborate? And so that was kind of the beginning of it, was just trying to do... mash up horror and noir into something. But I was really irritated, having been a huge fan of noir, that the women in most old noir movies and in old noir books are just really dumb characters, and the femme fatale is always a plot device, and it's always just the vagina of doom for whoever. And so I wanted to write a story that was from the point of view of the femme fatale, but then take it on a more epic scale and really kind of humanize that and make her, you know, make you root for who would normally be the bad guy in a story. And it just kind of built from there. It was only going to be 12 issues originally, I thought, and then I kept having more ideas for it. And I like the Lovecraftian horror stuff because basically you never actually see anything. It's always the people who worship some weird god who are terrifying. And to me, people who believe in religion are completely terrifying. So that was kind of like, that was the horror for me. It's like, imagine if people wanted to sacrifice you to their gods. And you know, that was kind of where it came from, was like, well, what if Barbara Stanwyck needed, you know, the father from My Three Sons to kill her husband because he wanted to Rosemary's Baby her, you know. Rosemary's Baby, the movie, not the NBC miniseries.
You know, we're running so low, so I want to actually see if there's a question from the audience. Do we have any questions for Sean and Ed? Yeah, okay. You know, we're going to have so little time, but you know what, you in the black shirt there, you in glasses. Yeah.
I was hoping that you guys could discuss the new series you're going to have with Image, the Hollywood one. I forgot the name.
The Fade Out? Yeah, that launches in the end of August. I don't want to talk about it too much just because we're so early in it, but it is basically, I think it's the most ambitious thing we've ever done, and it's kind of inspired by stories my aunt used to tell me before she got too senile to remember who I was, because my aunt and uncle were in Hollywood back in the 40s, and my aunt worked in PR on the Fox lot in the 30s and 40s, and my uncle was a famous screenwriter who wrote On the Beach and The Wild One and Murder, My Sweet, and I would always hear these stories when I was a kid about The Blacklist and all of his friends having their lives ruined. But I really wanted to write sort of the ultimate noir story, and I thought setting a noir story in the era of the noir boom in Hollywood, kind of. But I also think that era of America and American history is just fascinating because it's the post-war boom times. And Hollywood is kind of like the last American gold rush right then. But it's also at an era when Howard Hughes is trying to destroy the studio system because his studio can't compete. And so he's using a lot of money to sway the government to bust up the studio system. And it's just a really fascinating time. And I live in LA and I've been working in Hollywood the last couple of years, and it's not really because of that. I've been wanting to do a story like this for a while. But partly it was just, it's such a vast canvas to set a story in, and I wanted to do something that was a noir that had a broader scope that felt like an epic. So that, and then, you know, we were signing this deal with Image where we could do whatever I wanted, and I thought, well, there's no possible way to pitch this story that sounds commercial. So, you know, this is great. I'll do this first on our deal because they can't say no. Or, you know, and believe me, I've had plenty of emails from Kirkman going, can you please stop saying it's a noir? Just say it's a sexy thriller. But it is, I'm really excited about it. We actually hired a research assistant, so it will be the most realistic depiction of 40s Los Angeles that you've ever seen, probably.
Yeah, I won't have to fake it anymore.
Yeah, you won't have to fake it.
Someone has found us thousands of photographs.
Yeah, we're building a photo database of actual old Hollywood and for reference for Sean. And it's just a lot of fun, and it's just an era that I've always been fascinated by, and I have a story that I've sort of been... you know, waiting to tell. So now I get to, and Image has to publish it whether they want us to or not. But they want us to.
They love it more.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, let's get another question. Yeah, the blue shirt.
Will we see a third installment of Incognito?
If I ever figure out what to do next, maybe. Sean didn't really enjoy drawing that one, it turns out.
No, not really.
Superheroes
don't do anything for me. But we'd never planned on there being any more. It was always only going to be.
I think so. Yeah, the first one did so well. Yeah. And I felt like also there was a lot of stuff I wanted to get to in the first one that I didn't end up getting to. So that was part of why I wanted to do the second one. But But also, I think we'll probably do more criminal before we get back to that. We've talked about more criminal, and you know, one of the things that I've sort of been circling around is doing like a couple different criminal projects, you know, around our other stuff. So
let's start with one more from over here.
In the introduction to the criminal thought edition, they give us rights, you know, start off in fantasy and science fiction, you end up in crime. I thought, that's really weird because that's not what I mean. And I wonder, you found yourself, you know, something, you know, like, what's so great about crime? Like, there's no place, no one's flying around. Yeah. I mean,
for me, partly it's because I used to be a criminal when I was a teenager. I was a bad kid. I did drugs and dealt drugs to other kids when I was a kid, not as an adult. and I, you know, was a shoplifter for a long time. And I lived, when I was 17 or 18, I lived in a world that was a lot of sketchy people, and I saw a lot of weird stuff. And so that side of the world I've always felt like I had a little bit of an understanding of. But I also love the desperation of it, I think. Everybody at some point in life feels desperate and wants to have that one thing that'll make their life better. And I think that's what turns people to crime, is, you know, this, you know, either desperate love or desperate need to pay rent, or, you know, just this idea that you could have this one score that would change your whole life. It's like, it's the twisted version of the American dream. Right? You know, everybody's American dream is, you know, being the guy from the Beverly Hillbillies who shoots at a rabbit and becomes a billionaire because he hits oil, you know, and that it's I think crime is great for that. You know, everybody's motivated really easily in that. You don't ever have to worry about anyone. I mean, no one's trying to save the world in a crime story. So the stakes are so low that it's all human.
Do you enjoy those? I mean, obviously you don't like superheroes, so... I mean, what is it about...
Like, obviously. Are you talking to Sean?
Yeah. Sean, what is it about your work and your style that you think, you know, that just attracts you to this kind of story?
I think it's just that, you know, I naturally draw quite dark things, I think, and that stuff doesn't really suit superhero stuff for...
Yeah, you like to draw clothing folds.
Yeah,
smoke.
I like drawing, you know, real people rather than muscles. I'd have to learn anatomy if I want to draw a superhero.
Okay, one more question, because I really want to get so many urgent ones. All right, you know what? Front row.
I was curious about your writing style in terms of, like, how do you generate ideas? Like, how do you, your writing process, where do you start from? Like, do you know your characters first, or do you know the story first?
It's usually a character. Everything usually starts with a character. I was just thinking, we were at dinner last night and Darwin's wife showed us her picture on Google Earth, because she actually saw the Google car driving by and went and stood in front of their driveway flipping off the Google. And so her face is blurred, but she's going like this. And I was like, that's insane. But then I started thinking about the guy whose job it is to drive the Google Earth thing, and I thought, well, that's an interesting profession for someone to have that gets involved in a crime story. Like, I always start from that kind of a, literally something like, oh, what if you're a mobile locksmith and you happen to unlock someone's car who has dead bodies in it? Like, and then I start thinking, well, who is this guy? Who's the mobile locksmith? Why is he the mobile? Like, it always starts building from that, like figuring out who the main character is and then build their world around them. And, you know, sometimes I'll have a larger, you know, the fade out, it was more like I wanted to do something. I would compare it almost to Mad Men or something, where you want to sort of address an entire era in a way. But then at that point, it's like, well, how do I get into that story? And, you know, and then it's you start building that character that you're way in.
Do you share notes with, like, other creators who are writing the same genre?
Oh, fuck that. No. I don't know. I've never been part of like a writing group or anything. I used to be part of a cartooning group, but we would show each other our work and get feedback. But it was more about formalistic, you know, stuff and storytelling and things like that. No, I don't even show Sean any of my notes. I have tons of notebooks. Everything I do, I handwrite all my notebook stuff, and then I handwrite my outlines for the scripts, and then I have like a little easel next to my computer that has my notebook on it, and I make up everything as I'm typing, but I can look over and go, pages 11 through 13, this is the scene where he finds the dead body, and then I have to write that. And sometimes my notes will be more about what the character's thinking or feeling than what they're doing, and sometimes I'll have passages of narration that come to me while I'm writing the outline, and I'll just jot them down and then rewrite them as I'm typing. But yeah, I'm a huge notebooker. I take a lot of notes, and I have, you know, ideas in notebooks from 10 or 15 years ago, and sometimes in between projects I'll flip through and find some thing and go, oh, that'll work in this, and, you know, so there's a lot of that. But yeah, no, I don't bounce my ideas off my friends or anything. None of us really do that. We'll tell each other what we're going to do. Like, Fraction told me about Sex Criminals about 2 years before it came out. And I thought, oh, that's cool. That'll sell like 2,000 copies. And, you know.
Never underestimate sex.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know what? We are out of time here. And you guys, so much we haven't even talked about. So you guys just need to do like one of those books, you know. But yeah, thank you for coming, everybody. And thank you, Sean Phillips and Ed Brubaker.